Welcome to the podcast of Focus 580, featuring interviews with newsmakers and experts on international affairs and daily life, hosted by David Inge at WILL Radio, Urbana, Illinois. Please support this service by becoming a member and visit us on the web at will.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to the first hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. In this first part of the program, we'll be talking about the changing role of women in the global economy, something that our guests here for this first hour have spent a lot of time thinking about and speaking about and writing about. Our guest is Ruth Pearson. She is director of the Center for Development Studies at the University of Leeds in the UK, and she is here visiting the campus to talk about this topic. Her visit here is sponsored by a number of units on the campus, but primarily by the folks in Women and Gender and Global Perspectives. She'll be giving a talk on this subject here that we'll be discussing tomorrow afternoon at 4. This takes place at the Levis Faculty Center on the campus on Illinois Street. And anyone who is interested, I'm sure, can feel welcome to attend. As we talk here this morning, questions too are welcome. We just ask people to try to be brief in their questions so that we can get in as many as possible. But, of course, anyone who is listening is welcome also to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, if you have questions, you may call. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
To begin, I think probably we should remind people of something that I'm sure that they already know, although I'm not sure how much they think about it, but certainly people should already know that here, for example, here in the United States, so many of the products that we use routinely every day without really thinking very much about it, particularly things like textiles and clothing and shoes and electronics, are produced by international corporations, multinational corporations, and are manufactured someplace else, not here, and certainly not here in the United States. And that's been true for some time now, but it seems to be increasingly true. So that is a point we have to start with and remind people.
That's right. And not only do many of the things that we buy and we use in our families and in our houses are produced in low-wage countries. And as you say, they're produced by multinational companies. But what's happened over the last 30 years is that system's got more complex. And so there's a lot of subcontracting. And often the multinational companies are not the main producer. They contract it to other intermediaries.
Hmm. The other point is that gets us into the issue of talking about gender, which I think is a thing that maybe people won't their awareness won't be as much as at least the other idea, is that the people who are doing the manufacturing, who are making a lot of these things, the clothes and the shoes and the electronics and a lot of other things, are women.
That's right. A lot of the manufacturing processes that are outsourced, that are carried out in low-wage economies, are assembly processes, putting things together, soldering electronic components together, sewing up bits of garments and things. And that requires what we've come to know as nimble fingers. And one of the interesting things about that is, yes, it's women who traditionally have been sought because they have those skills for a number of reasons. But also, that's thought of as unskilled work. And so the companies don't have to pay for that skill. They get it. It comes with the woman and it comes cheap.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this is an interesting area and invites the question, why particularly women? And often we're really talking about young women here. Why is it that for the people who are, you know, whether it is you're putting together pieces that are going to end up to be in a computer or something, or whether you're talking about blue jeans or, you know, whatever it is, why particularly are women such a desirable for your workers?
Well, of course, it's no different to the situation in the United States or in Western Europe. Women have always been sought for these kind of manual intensive, labor intensive processes that require manual dexterity. And there's all kinds of reasons why it's women that are better than this. And what the psychology research shows is that if you take very small babies, they perform just about the same. But over time, over their life course, women learn to be much more dexterous. Now, not, of course, every woman, but on average. So that's why women are sought, because they do these things very quickly. They do it accurately. And also, what's an important part of the reason why women are a good labor force for these kind of things, they're docile. That is, they don't tend to join unions. They don't tend to disobey orders. They tend to do as they're told, and they tend to deliver the results the companies want.
Yeah, that was certainly one of the things that I would have expected that would be true, that, you know, perhaps not only would be these workers be valued for their skills, but that potential employers would think that they would be easier to handle, that they would be less trouble, in fact, than if the workforce was male.
Well, I think that's both the perception and, to some extent, the reality, because it's not that the companies have tried out men and women and decided women are less trouble. They've sought a female labor force from the beginning, mm-hmm. because for all kinds of reasons, society reasons, family reasons, women tend to be more submissive and more amenable to doing what they're told to do. So they're sought for that reason, and also because of their skills in terms of manual dexterity. But as I said, these aren't seen as skills that have to be paid for in terms of higher wages.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you now, if you're looking at a workforce like this that is primarily young women, and you look at those things that should apply to any worker, you talk about their working conditions, you talk about potential hazards on the job, you talk about the what their work means for their life. Are the issues different for these workers because they are women than they would be if we were talking about men?
Well, of course, the basic labor rights and standards should apply to everybody. And the ILO core standards, indeed, are meant to cover everybody. No forced labor, no child labor, no discrimination, freedom of association. Those are the core standards that the international system says should apply to everybody. But when you take women workers, there are some specific issues, because usually they are caught between their role as earning money and their role in the family as daughters and wives and mothers. So issues like forced overtime, for example, is very important, because if people have a domestic role, they have to get back to take care of the kids or whatever, and the company says, no, you've got to work 2 or 4 hours overtime. This presents a problem for them. Similarly, issues like harassment, verbal harassment, sexual harassment, physical harassment. These are particularly gendered forms of problems that women face. In some industries, like electronics, where you're dealing with hazardous substances, it has been alleged that also prolonged exposure can lead to specific problems to do with reproduction and pregnancy and so on. So there are a number of women-specific issues that these workers do face.
Mm-hmm. Here, I think in the United States, employers are somewhat becoming more sensitive to the same kinds of issues. At least we have gone from a point, I think, where employers would say to workers, look, we're paying you to do the job. You may have problems with your life outside of work, but that's not my, as an employer, that's not my problem. You know, I don't want to hear about your child care problems. I don't want to hear about your health problems. I don't want to hear about anything else. You're here to do the job. I'm going to pay you. And then you go home and that's your, you know, that's your business. And I think now probably more employers are starting to think it's important for them to pay attention to other aspects of their workers' lives, if only because it makes their workers more productive, if they can help them deal with issues like that.
I think that's right. I think that employers do respond to the political situation. And I think here in the West, there has been a long process of sensitizing employers to the issues that women workers face and to the fact that they are going to be better employees if employers are sensitive to what we now call the work-life balance. Okay. But I think in third world countries, the situation is slightly different in that the reason that these people, these women workers are being used is precisely because they are cheap. They could cost 1/50th per hour of what a worker in the United States could cost. And then you have to ask the question, well, what are the employers paying for? They're paying a wage. What does the wage cover? Certainly in Western Europe and in North America, the wage doesn't have to cover everything because there's all kinds of other services supplied through taxation, health, education, transportation, security, and so on. In third world countries, that may not be the case, so that the wage is all the person gets. And from that, their whole family, their whole community has to be sustained and reproduced. So I think the issues are similar, they're parallel, but the context is so different.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would think that it would be even more difficult in a context like that to get employers even to think about the other sorts of things. I mean, think about, for example, the childcare needs of their workers. I mean, it's tough enough here in the United States sometimes to get employers to think about that. But if we're talking about a developing country, and particularly if we're talking about one of these situations, as you say, where you have a company that's putting out a product under their name and they're contracting with somebody else to make it, and then that party is contracting with somebody else to make part of that, you know, the further you get down the line, it's going to be difficult for you to establish some kind of accountability if you're the if you're the person at the head of the line and it's your name that's getting stamped on the product, right?
No, I think that's right. But I think also precisely because these are global chains of production, there has been a global mobilization to encourage the companies to take responsibilities right down the production chain. And if you take some of the big brand names like Nike, like Reebok, like Levi's and so on, they have adopted in recent years voluntary corporate codes of conduct, which says that anything that goes out with their brand on has to fulfill the conditions set by their codes of conduct. And I think that is an important step forward because, okay, it's difficult to sustain, it's difficult to monitor and verify, but it does mean that global pressure has been put on these global value chains that there should be some corporate responsibility right down that production line.
But still, we're talking about here a situation where we're a few well-known, high-profile companies that have faced public pressure have responded to that. That I'm sure that there still are a lot of workers who maybe work for other companies where the lines of responsibility are less clear and certainly have not faced the kind of organized pressure by consumers who are concerned about this that companies like, for example, Nike have faced.
I mean, that's true. But on the other hand, things start small and they grow. And I think one of the things about codes of conduct is that it does set a standard that other firms and other producers can aspire to. Also, I think it's a mistake to think that when you have these subcontractors, that one works for Nike, one works for Reebok and so on. What you often have is an enterprise that one week is making Nike trainers and the next week is making Reebok. So they're actually the same things. And so what it does is, I think, put a general upward pressure and bring these issues into the public domain, both in the consumer country and in the producer country, so that workers begin to think, well, there are some rights. I am entitled to rights. I don't have to suffer these conditions. Maybe there are alternatives. So I think, yes, of course, some of these companies, and I think for very good market reasons, have led the way. And there are still problems about whether these codes are actually followed right down the line. Mm. And indeed, some of the codes are quite narrow in what they contain. But nevertheless, I think it's a really important tool towards securing better conditions for third world workers.
Yeah. Well, we certainly have seen some of these kinds of organized efforts by consumers to pressure some companies to pay attention to working conditions for their workers in the third world. And for example, a lot of them have happened because of organized groups on college campuses who are the ones who wear the shoes and the T-shirts and have put pressure on retailers like The Gap and manufacturers like Nike and Reebok, for example. One of the things that I wonder is whether there is a more general kind of awareness among consumers about these issues, or are the numbers of people who are really concerned They may be fairly well organized and they may be vocal, but they're actually small if you look at the total number of people out there who are running around and wearing these shoes, for example.
Well, I mean, certainly there is a vanguard, if you like, and, you know, it's not surprising that college students are the most conscious, the most educated about what happens internationally. But I think what has happening is part of a more general trend. I don't know the figures in the United States, but certainly in the UK, the spread of fair traded goods has been enormous in recent years of ethical investment. We have something called the Ethical Trading Initiative, in which all the big supermarkets and big producers have organized in order to have their own code of conduct for fresh produce as well as manufactured produce. So I think this is a very important, and it's a growing movement. It may have started small, but I think it's spreading, and there's much more consciousness. People see things on the TV, they read things in the newspapers, they hear things on the radio. There is a lot more consciousness, and people are much more widely concerned, I think, than what happened, say, you know, 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah, and that has that actually resulted in noticeable improvement for things like working conditions and wages for the people who are then doing the producing of the product?
In some situations, it has. I mean, one of the successes, if you like, that we can document and quantify has been, certainly in Europe, the supply of fresh produce, flowers, out-of-season vegetables and fruits and so on from East and Southern Africa. And in that situation, you have the Ethical Trading Initiative Code being applied. So all kinds of abuses, like no contract, temporary work, no insurance, no toilets on the field, all these kind of things have indeed been produced. Have indeed been improved. But another trend I think is important. For example, everybody's worried about what's happening with the growth of production from China and how that's displacing other producers all over the world. And one of the things that has been introduced is a system where you have a long-term commitment to certain suppliers. And so you give the suppliers an incentive to change towards better conditions. You don't just say, okay, if you don't do what we say, we'll cut off your contract. And then everybody loses, including the workers. You say, okay, if you work with us over 5 years, these are the goals that we want you to reach. And we will work with you to do that. So I think there's all kinds of ways in which this can be spread and which people are really beginning to feel the benefits. Hmm.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Ruth Pearson. She is director of the Center for Development Studies at the University of Leeds in the UK and has for a number of years now been doing research on the changing role of the women's changing role in the global economy. And she's here to talk on the subject. We'll give a talk tomorrow afternoon on the campus. And we're here open to questions. And we have someone here who is ready to go, and others are certainly welcome to join the conversation. 333-9455, that's for Champaign-Urbana, where we are. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here. You'll need to put on those headphones so that you can hear what the caller has to say. In Indiana, here, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Besides the usual things we all know about how women are treated in the workplace in terms of even at the high levels, there may be a VP at one salary and the male VP, a comparable job and all that kind of stuff, will be getting more. I was wondering if those things occur in other countries if women do make it up, you know, to the glass floor. And in particular, I wonder if it's cultural specific to, I started thinking about it, hell, it may just be Western countries, but sexual harassment on the job, wherever that might be, whether it's in the factory, out on, you know, working on electric lines or in the top offices. I wonder if that problem arises in other countries too, other than just Western countries. We ain't got, you know, Hollywood's made, you know, millions of dollars out of the office secretary and all that kind of stuff. And I was wondering if other countries have that, other women in other countries have that problem too. And if so, if there are other little things like that are culturally cemented in one country or another, where the women have, you know, besides the low wages and other things that can be brought up by the economists, there's those more or less psychological things that impede in their brain, things like that. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Well.
Okay, thank you. You've raised some really important points, and I'll try and deal with them all. The issue about pay discrimination is an interesting question on several points. Firstly, because of the way a lot of these processes are organized, it's difficult to say there's not equal pay, because very often women are 80, 90% all the operating labor force. So who do you compare them to? When you look at the hierarchies, you can see that as you go up to supervisor, management and so on, they very often, those positions are held by men. But that's not seen to be unequal pay, because they're doing different kinds of jobs. The issue in many cases is, are women getting the minimum wage, the stipulated minimum wage, and are they getting all the non-wage benefits that the law says they should be entitled to? And that's often the issue where there's most struggle about. In terms of women breaking through the glass ceiling, I think there is evidence, particularly in parts of East Asia, where women are rising very rapidly to management positions, and in the new industries associated with communication technologies, not only electronics, but customer services, all these new kinds of activities that are being outsourced. And in China, for example, as well as women working on the production lines at very low pay, you see more and more women executives in corporations as well. So that very well may be a trend to look for in the future. In terms of your second point about sexual harassment and things, I think there is fairly widespread evidence that all over the world, women are subject to sexual harassment in different kinds of contexts. And it might take different forms. A lot of women workers in East Asia and Southeast Asia, for example, complain not only of sexual harassment, but actually physical harassment from management. And that's quite a different kind of management style than, say, American corporations. A lot of the complaints in the 70s and 80s were that American companies would come into countries like Malaysia and set up very Western kind of consumerist management styles, where the worker who produced the most in the week or the month would be given a free weekend in a honeymoon hotel, or beauty products or that kind of thing. And there was a reaction to this, and there was the notion that this wasn't the kind of cultural intrusion that was appropriate in the situation. So a lot of that kind of thing has changed. But nevertheless, in Central America, in Thailand, in China, in Sri Lanka, really all over the world, research does indicate that women complain about sexual harassment from male bosses and male supervisors and male management. So I don't think it's just culturally specific specific to the West. The issue about psychological conditioning, I think this is part of what I referred to earlier as the docility, which is so prized by management. If women are conditioned to accept male authority in the family, in the community, in the state or whatever, then it's quite easy to transfer that authority from the family or the community leaders to the management of the factory. And if women have been conditioned to accept it, they will quite often go on accepting it.
Mm-hmm. Well, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. How many of the countries that we're talking about have a minimum wage that actually is set by law?
Most countries have a minimum wage that is set by law, but it's complicated in that, firstly, very often minimum wages are set, but they're not enforced. They state often doesn't have the capacity, if it does have the will, to inspect and control this. Secondly, companies are quite good at evading the legislation where it exists. One way is to take on so-called temporary workers for a trial period, which could last up to 3 or 6 months, at which they're paid apprentice kind of wages. And at the end of 6 months, they have to break the contract. And if they want to be reemployed again, they're employed as new workers. Then there's the issues of the non-wage benefit. You may get the minimum hourly wage, but you may not get all the legally stipulated benefits that come with that. Or there's the question of overtime. I mean, does the minimum wage, is it set for a week or a month? Is it specific to the hours you work? Are you entitled to overtime? Are you entitled to holidays? Should there be a 40-hour week or a 50-hour week or a 70-hour week or in some cases a 90-hour week? Mm-hmm. So it's quite a complicated question.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with another caller. This is someone in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Yes. I missed part of the program, so perhaps you've discussed this, but we haven't heard much lately about the situation in the maquiladoras on our own border. We've heard a lot about illegal immigration and so forth, but there was a time when we were getting horrendous reports of young women working in the maquiladoras who were not only subject to sexual harassment and so forth, but to actual torture and even murder. And I'm wondering if your guest has any up-to-date information on that.
Good morning. Yes, that's a very important issue, and I'm glad you raised that. The situation on the maquilas, the maquiladora plants on the southern side of the U.S.-Mexico border, is really a very live issue. Partly because the kind of processing is changing very rapidly, the kind of industries. So there has, in some places, been quite a masculinization of the workforce. New industries with more technology, car assembly, car components, that kind of thing, tend to employ men rather than women. So the percentage of women workers has gone down. But as you say, particularly in Ciudad Juarez, there have been over the last decade, really, increasing number of young women who've been found murdered, often tortured, sexually assaulted, and so on. And there has been increasing international concern that the perpetrators have not yet been brought to justice. Now, that has raised a lot of discussion about why conditions aren't better, because the kind of women that are found dead are either workers in maquiladora plants or come from the same neighborhoods as those workers are recruited from. And what's happened to date is there's been the Mexican authorities have been criticized for not taking these things seriously. But secondly, the companies have said, this is nothing to do with us. We're only concerned with what happens when women are in the factories. And in fact, there was one case reported where a woman came to work and she was 3 or 4 minutes late for her shift. So she was sent home. And sometime later, she was found murdered. So there is a very close connection between these murders and the fact that this is the labor force from which these women workers are drawn. And this is an issue that is of very current concern.
Is it figuring as an issue in Mexico's election, which is going on now, election campaign?
I think there has been increasing pressure on the government, both at provincial, state level and at national level, to solve these murders. The pressure has been very much on the police and the judicial authorities. It's not yet an issue to put pressure on the companies themselves.
I see. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. Well, this the very question that the listener poses gets us back to some of the things we were talking about a little bit earlier, and that is to what extent that employers feel that they're they have some responsibility for the quality of life and the safety of their workers outside the plant. What happens to them in the rest of their life, what happens to them when they're going to and from work? As you say, I think that it has been the case that some of these employers would say, look, that's not our responsibility. It's our responsibility involves what happens to the worker from the point that she walks in the door to work, and then the day is over and she turns around and goes out the door. Once she's out the door, this is not our problem. Is there, in fact, some increasing willingness of employers to say, well, yes, in fact, this in a sense is our problem too?
Yes, again, I think this is a reflection of the kind of political mobilization around these issues that we've seen over the last 10, 15 years. In the area that is called corporate social responsibility, employers, or companies, I should say, have been increasingly concerned about the perception people have of their company, not just about their products, but their company. Does it do more than produce and employ people to produce? Or what effect does it actually have on the communities in which it operates? People have said many times that the value of a company is 70, 80% reputation. And so companies are very sensitive to these kind of issues. And you've seen companies introducing a corporate social responsibility policy, which covers not only what happens to the workforce, but also covers what happens in the community. Many oil companies, for example, have been forced to consider the farming livelihoods and the environmental issues in the communities in which they operate. And industrial companies, to some extent, are being forced to consider not just what happens to working conditions, but also what happens to the communities in the locations in which they operate. Mm.
We are a little bit past the midpoint here. Perhaps I should introduce once again our guest. Ruth Pearson is director of the Center for Development Studies at the University of Leeds in the UK. And she is here visiting the campus, her visit sponsored in primarily by the Women and Gender in Global Perspective program. And she's going to be talking about this very subject, and that is corporate gender responsibility in the global era, in a talk tomorrow afternoon at 4. This takes place at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus on Illinois Street in Urbana. And I'm sure anybody who is interested in attending should feel welcome. And here on the program as well, anyone who would like to call in, questions, comments are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Is it possible to cite an example or two, perhaps, of some corporation that you think has done a notably good job dealing with the corporate responsibility, social responsibility, in this particular way that we're talking about, particularly as it applies to the large numbers of women that ultimately work for them?
Well, I wouldn't like to give any specific examples, but I think that corporations, if you look at the company codes of, say, the big sports and leisure companies like Nike and Reebok and Levi's, which was one of the earliest, you will find that not only do the codes cover what happens, the working conditions in the workplace, but they've actually set up trusts, charitable organizations, which invest in sustainable livelihoods and local communities. So I think this is a beginning, but again, a growing trend that a lot of the big corporations are doing. I mean, some people are very skeptical about this. There's this phrase, blue wash, that they think people say it's just a PR exercise. Mm-hmm. And I know that Nestle, for example, which is a company that's been heavily criticized over the years, initially for breaking the codes on marketing of infant formula in developing countries, held out for many, many years against having any kind of fairly traded product, and has set up a corporate social responsibility initiative in Ethiopia, which supports local communities growing coffee and so on. And indeed, recently has introduced a fair trade product, having said for years and years that it wouldn't go along that line. So that I think you can see across the spectrum all kinds of initiatives taking place, which is beginning to, if not have a massive effect, but to design or to imagine what things could be like if this tendency grew. Mm.
The Nestle case, I think, is interesting, and I don't know if people will remember this, but I think for a lot of people, this was the starting point for this kind of pressure by consumers and concerned people on a large corporation to behave in certain ways. And it, basically, it goes back to the time when Nestle was in the developing world aggressively marketing powdered baby formula and persuading women not to breastfeed and to use this formula. The huge problem was access to clean water. And it was actually creating far more problems than it was solving a problem that wasn't really a problem. It was creating a lot of problems eventually made the Nestle a target of a lot of anger and organized people around the world who were saying, look, this is not a good thing that you're doing. And I think for some people, that's a classic sort of a case study and a place where the kind of thing that we're talking about really started. And I'm not sure that there was that much of this kind of pressure on corporations to be good citizens around the world before that particular case.
No, I think that was a landmark mobilization. And to some extent, it's gone on. I mean, the issue with Nestle wasn't just that infant formula was a problem because of access to clean water and things, but it was also very expensive. And so, women who were using it were not preparing the formula at correct strength because they just couldn't afford it. I mean, there were a whole series of issues. And this is what the initial international mobilization started about. And I think it's an interesting case, too, because Nestle is still concerned that its reputation and therefore its market, because people pressure by taking their custom elsewhere. And there was a boycott of Nestle products, very widespread for a number of years. And so Nestle have been very sensitive to this. But I think it's also an example where the changing nature of business means that one has to be quite vigilant. Because as I understand it, infant formula only applies to products for infants under 6 months. And as many young families will know, and I know from my own grandchildren, that there's now a market in what's called follow-on formula and follow-on weaning foods and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. Now, it's an open question. Is that subject to international regulation or not? And therefore, how far should the WHO Code of Good Practice extend? I mean, I think these are very interesting questions. But I think what's also very important is that corporations like Nestle are engaging in these issues rather than denying that it's anything to do with them.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting that this thing that we're talking about, this Nestle case, goes back to the 70s, that it would still be the case today that there are people who think badly of Nestle still because of this back then? Or is this just that Nestle is just, because of the experience, they are extraordinarily sensitive to the idea that someone would think badly of them?
I mean, I think there continues to be a sensitivity amongst the big brand names. I mean, there were in Europe student campuses who boycotted Nestle products for a long time, and I'm not sure whether that still goes on today. But if you take any of the big companies, I think Levi Strauss was also in the 80s one of the first companies that was subject to a kind of global consumer boycott. And the first company in the garment sector to have a company code of conduct in response. But Nike is the Gap. All these companies are very sensitive about public opinion and market opinion about their products, which means that it's a very fertile time for people to engage with these corporations and to have a dialogue that is going to move towards improving conditions on the ground. So although, as I said earlier, there's a lot of skepticism, I personally feel a lot of optimism in that it is possible to organize and to mobilize and to make things better.
Let's talk with another listener here, someone in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, I wanted to mention that in a recent article of The Economist, there was a large article about women and the world economy and how important they are. But I wanted to ask you about an article I clipped from the Daily Telegraph
about 3 years ago, also about a professor from Leeds, Beverly Alimo Metcalf, and she had done a study which showed that women were considered better bosses, at least by their coworkers, and that in the entire workforce considered them better bosses and managers, but that the only group that didn't consider them better managers were the top positions, which were all held by men, and that therefore that was the problem. And I was just wondering, because those men were like the gatekeeper of senior posts, and they were preventing women from progressing, I was wondering if there had been an update on that study, if it's still true that most workers consider women the better managers and bosses. Thanks.
Okay. Well, I'm not familiar with that particular study, but I mean, I do think there's been quite a lot of research talking about a female style of management, a more discursive, less authoritarian, less hierarchical, more collegial type of management style. And I think some corporations are training and encouraging male managers to adopt that style. The question of gatekeeping is interesting. I think one just, I mean, it's not for me to say, but I mean, I think if you look at the Politburo or the cabinet or the government or the executive management committee or the board of major corporations, major public institutions and major states, you still see that men predominate in large numbers. Now, this may be because of natural ability, or there may be some other thing going on, and I don't really feel it's for me to say.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580, talking with Ruth Pearson, director of the Center for Development Studies at the University of Leeds in the UK. She is someone who has been studying women's changing role in the global economy for a long time now, and we'll be talking about that tomorrow afternoon on the U of I campus. Questions here, welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Well, just again to go back to this question of what it is, how it is employers think about their workers and what they're responsible for, has one seen an expansion of what employers are willing to do, you know, past the point of providing a wage that does take into consideration that women have a life outside of the workplace, and they have families, and they have children, and they have other responsibilities, and then there are these larger issues that just might have to go to basic sort of health and safety.
Well, I think in Western countries there has been a recognition that the welfare of the workforce is very tied up with the welfare of the corporation. But this is in contexts where states can regulate about maternity leave, about childcare provision, and so on. And I think the work-life balance debate has moved a lot, certainly in Europe, in recent years. I think with developing countries, it's much more difficult because the state does not have the capacity or the ability. And a lot of international development policies have worked against that kind of responsibility. A lot of the economic recovery structural adjustment programs put in place by the Washington institutions have meant that people, very poor people, have had to pay directly for primary health services, for primary and secondary education. So in a sense, you can say the trend's been going in a different direction. And it is notoriously very, very difficult to collect taxes from businesses in developing countries. So I don't think there's yet been much movement there, which is why I think we have to engage the consciousness and the corporate social responsibility agenda of the corporations to begin to make inroads. I mean, at the UN level, there's been all kinds of social compacts and discussions about how corporations want to get involved in provision of and securing of basic services. But I don't think we were at that point yet.
So you think it is more likely that if it's going to happen, it's not going to be because the countries where the businesses locate require it. It's going to be because the corporations are going to think it's in our best interest because our image is important for us to be able to demonstrate to consumers that we're doing this. And so they're going to do it that way, not because someone has come along and said, we've passed this law that you have to follow.
Well, laws are only as good as the political climate and the capacity to implement them. But businesses are businesses. They want to make a profit. They want to succeed. They want to increase their market share. And if they are convinced that this is a way to do it and a way to show that their global market, that they are concerned for the welfare of the workforce and for the locations in which they operate, yes, I think they will be motivated in that way.
For consumers, I'm interested in, as you say, there are probably more people who are concerned about this. They're at least thinking about who it is that produces the jeans they wear and the shoes they wear and the other things. And they're interested in corporations that have some kind of commitment to social responsibility. It's all well and good for a corporation to say that it does. Is it possible for a consumer, for example, to really know whether, in fact, a corporation is following its own rules? Or is there, who is it there that is trying to provide some kind of oversight so that they can say, yes, whatever corporation we're talking about, not only do they have a code of conduct, but they actually follow it?
This is an important issue that has been dealt with in a number of ways. There are certain international standards, SA 8000 and so on, where corporations say that they follow these standards. And there are a lot of not-for-profit organizations involved in monitoring and verifying whether or not companies are actually implementing this. Some of the companies use very big international accounting firms to verify and monitor. And this is not thought to be terribly convincing to the consumers. It's better to use an organization that is at arm's length. And companies do publish their CSR reports and their monitoring reports. And a lot of these are available on their website or through electronic means.
Let's talk with someone else here in Urbana, line one. Hello?
Yes, good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, just fine.
Good. Hi. Okay. Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to emphasize that there is a local store in our town that is representative of the whole fair trade world. It's called 10,000 Villages. It's under the auspices of the Mennonite Church. We have stores all over the country and in Canada. We are run by volunteers. The managers are paid. And we have items made by artisans from all over the world, third world countries mostly, obviously. And they are guaranteed a living wage for their country. And they are given money as a startup for the product before they even start making it so that they have something to start with. And then they are paid for the product before it leaves their country. And we invite people to come to our store. It's downtown on Walnut Street. And there we have a brochure of the stores all over the country. So if you get a chance to visit us, we'd love to have you while you're here.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you for that. I think that's an important issue because I think for a long time there have been what I call solidarity trade initiatives, fair trade supported by particular communities, churches, labor organizations, and so on, that have really encouraged the development of different ways of thinking about international trade. I think what I'm talking about is the importance of scaling that up to make it not the exception, but the general rule in terms of how we do business internationally.
Well, actually, our business has just grown phenomenally. I can't give you any, statistics on that, but word spreads and people find the products to be beautiful, but also we say it's shopping without guilt. And it's just been amazing how many stores have multiplied under our auspices. And then there's Oxfam, of course, in Europe. It's been around a lot longer than we have. So, yes, I'm really excited to see the growth of this kind of thing, and I agree with you. I mean, the whole thing with the coffee, it's amazing. It just started out with one or two, and now there's companies all over that are doing that.
Yeah, fair trade coffee. Yeah.
And I think what's important about the coffee is that you see it in your local stores. I think specialized stores are important, right, but you can see it in your local supermarket, right, and that shows the difference that is happening in recent times.
Exactly. And even Starbucks has a brand.
That's right.
So, thank you.
All right. Well, thank you for the call. Well, I think that, though, that again, that points to something that we have touched on a couple of times, that is there seems to be real and growing demand among consumers who are concerned about this, and that obviously there are some retailers, some people on a sort of a smaller scale, but then some on a bigger scale, who have realized that it's in their corporate bottom line could be affected, and it's in their best interest to do that. And now, so you know, maybe we haven't quite seen it so much on the scale of a corporation that makes millions of pairs of shoes or whatever it is, but perhaps that it's something that we should expect in the future, that we are going to see more, because among consumers there is a rising level of awareness, and among businesses there is this awareness that it can affect their bottom line.
I think that's right. I mean, the businesses, we're the shareholders, we're the customers. It's our economic power and our political will that's going to make a difference.
Well, we're going to have to finish up because we've here come to the end of the time. Again, though, for people who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, I do want to mention that our guest, Ruth Pearson, director of the Center for Development Studies at University of Leeds in the UK, is here visiting the campus and will give a talk on this very subject, talking about corporate gender responsibility in the global era. Tomorrow afternoon, 4 o'clock at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. That's on West Illinois. There are many sponsors, but primarily here sponsored by the Women and Gender and Global Perspectives program on the U of I campus. We want to say to you, Professor Pearson, thank you very much.
Thank you.